Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 918. This episode brought to you by Future Man.
Future Man.
A new Hulu original series. It's Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. Seth's going to be on the podcast soon. Jonah, you sat in on that one too.
I did sit in on it, yeah.
Jonah's like coming back around the Nerdist podcast. Matt, we're still not sure what time zone he's in right now. But anyway, Future Man. Starring Josh Hutcherson, Future Man.
A
janitor by day, hapless gamer by night. He was tasked when traveling back in time to prevent the extinction of humanity, which is brought on by the cure for herpes. So don't miss this epic action comedy series. All episodes now are streaming only on Hulu. It's... I didn't say it yet. I didn't say it yet.
I want to be right on top of it.
Future Man.
Future Stone for your poolside.
That's not what we rehearsed.
Future Man.
We don't sit and rehearse these intros for hours on end for you to come in and improvise, Jonah.
Yeah. No, I know that. I know that well. Sorry, I was supposed to do that before, when you were saying the other line.
Yeah, Katie, you said it all that in together, so Jonah's just agreeing on with me for everything.
When you're in final draft, you got to split the dialogue so I know to do it at the same time.
Right. Yeah, okay, good. I'm going to be in Portland at Helium December 7th through 9, so please come out to that. Helium Portland, great club. Portland, great city.
Great city.
Portland, Oregon. Katie Levine.
I just want to remind people that we have some other great shows on the network, like the Todd Glass Show, which is nonstop laughs from Todd Glass and his friends.
He playing more music?
More jingles. Malton on Movies with legendary movie critic Leonard Maltin. Houndtail Discussion Series hosted by Moshe Kasher, which dives into interesting topics every month. And also the Nerd Melt Showroom has fun, exciting, and totally affordable comedy shows every single night. There's stand-up, live podcasts, improv, so much more. So you can find tickets and info at nerdmeltla.com.
I don't believe it.
Really huge lack of Jonah Radio in that list of podcasts on the network.
You know what? I'm choosing three at a time and highlighting those.
That's all right.
To be fair, you did abandon that for a while.
I didn't. We never said we were on a schedule. We said we were going to keep it fun. And you try to wrangle, like, it's like, think of me and Matt on our worst day, and it's Cash and Neil are 10 times worse.
That's gonna be his funny take. I instantly got a picture
for listeners of both. You're gonna love that.
Do you have anything you want to plug?
No, I don't have anything. I don't have anything to plug. I'm
Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah, Mystery Science Theater 3000 is on Netflix. 14 episodes. Hit America's on VRV, verve.co. First season free in front of the paywall. Second season, you got to sign up. Verve also has Harmon Quest. Yes. Harmon Quest, My Brother and Me, this show. Yep. Like all the little CISO orphans, a couple of us went over to VRV.co and watch Hidden America. I'm very proud of it. And then Turkey Day Marathon coming up on Thanksgiving.
Fantastic. This episode is Hari Kondabolu, who is promoting The Problem with Apu, which is a documentary premiering November 19th on True TV. And he's a good friend and a great comic and was on At Midnight a bunch. And I really enjoyed this documentary. I really did. I went into it. I mean, I talked to him about it. And I went into it like, what is this all about? And I watched it. I was like, oh, yeah, well, it's really good. It makes a lot of great points.
Yeah.
So, but I really, I adore Hari. And it was really, he's just great. He's such a smart guy.
He's a good, solid dude.
He's a solid dude. Really funny. If you have a chance to see him, he's touring right now. December 1st, he'll be at the Fox Theater in Oakland. December 7th, Texas Theater in Dallas. December 8th, Austin at Stateside, at the Paramount. 12-9, Houston Secret Group. December 10th, New Orleans Joy Theater. The 13th, Aladdin in Portland, which is great. And the 15th, in December 15th, he's recording at the Neptune in Seattle, which is another great place. And Bobcat's directing his special.
That's right. Yeah, Hari's a really great. He has a great album on Kill Rock Stars Records.
It's really good.
Yeah, it's a fantastic comedy record. So we go get his stuff, support him.
Excellent. Here's the Nerdist Podcast number 918. With Hari Kondabolu. Katie, please roll the thing.
Future Man.
I didn't even say it that time.
You did in the future.
Shit.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Sort of just talking about like the pre-conversation was had to do with when companies try to force people to go to internet portals, then almost in defiance the audience will go like no, because you told me to. And a lot of times it has to do with just not having a good interface or not having a good user experience or not, you know, or only having one thing that people want to see. But in general, you cannot. It's like trying to force a tornado to go in a direction. Like, well, it's going to go where it's going to go.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And you
know.
So
what do you think then? A la carte all over the place? That's the way stuff should be?
I think people will not ultimately enjoy a la carte because you would psychologically be in the undertow of choice, which is very stressful.
Yeah. Right.
And you also don't think most people want to do the work of I'll grab. They don't want to cherry pick their own stuff.
Yeah.
People just want a platform that goes here. And they go, "Okay, that's good. That is right. More than, you know, I can more than 50% justify, you know, there's just enough here that I will give you $5 a month for this thing."
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah, definitely.
They almost want what TV used to be with five channels and these are the choices, so I'll pick one of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also people, you know, we're so spoiled as consumers now because we can get exactly what we want however and whenever we want it that there used to be like a real compromise where you'd watch something and go, yeah, this, you know, this wouldn't be my first choice, but it's on and there's nothing else
right,
on.
So right, right,
now
right.
It's like, not only do you have to be 100% into something, but if it's not exactly what people want, it's like their fucking enemy.
Yeah.
It's like, this needs to go away. Like, well, you could just not watch it. No, I want this fucking pulled from the...
Yeah. Like, who goes to a museum and then just sticks around the painting they hate the most just to talk to other people about
this
it?
This needs to go away.
This needs to go away. Should be blue.
It's called blue.
How do reruns of old shows survive then? Because, like, growing up, it was like you went home after school and there was all these reruns. Yeah. And I'd see shows that I've never even seen before that were canceled. And that's how I knew. But why would kids now do that? There's no reason to do that.
I don't know if kids would, but I think there's enough. There really still are enough people in the country, in a country of 350 million people. There still are enough people that listen to radio and, you know, watch, you know, will watch like the My 13 and they'll just watch old reruns.
I watch My 13.
Well, because especially in a time that feels so tumultuous, I think people are going to race to nostalgia because it's very comforting and you don't have to think about it. You know, what do you watch? What are your nostalgia choices?
I mean, The Simpsons often.
Yeah,
seasons 1 to 10, right? Are still, you know,
you go up to 10. A lot of people don't go up to 10.
Really?
I always hear people cutting off around 7, 8.
I went to about 10, and then it gets really.
Yeah, you know. Caitlin Gill says that she's like there's another golden era, like seasons like 16 through 18.
That's
or
in the early 2000s.
Like, I can't remember which exactly she said. She's like, no, there was another golden
That's
era
hilarious.
That no one talks about. Yeah.
That's well, a documentary, the second golden era of Simpsons.
Yeah, congratulations on your documentary, by the way. The Problem with Apu, which is appearing on True TV Sunday.
Yes.
Did you see it yet? You haven't seen it because it hasn't aired.
I haven't seen it because it hasn't aired. Yeah.
I have a link to it. I'll send it to you, and then you should watch it.
Cool. Go back in time. Send it to me. I can engage our friend.
It's the Bill and Ted thing. I'm going to remember to go back in time. And then all of a sudden, Jonah goes, hey, it was great.
Yeah. But just a little blood comes out of my nose because the past has been changed.
Yeah.
Are they making a third one? Bill and Ted, because they said they were going to.
They always talk about it. You know, Alex Winter's been on the podcast a couple times. He says there's a story. You know, every once in a while he talks to Keanu, and Keanu seems to be into it. And you'll hear a tittering of it on the internet, like, oh, it's going to, and then it doesn't happen.
It would be rad if, though, Ted does have all the skills that John Wick has now. Like, now he's just this badass fighter.
That would
in, like, a post-apocalyptic, like, they messed up the future so badly that now like they both have like these John Wick skills.
That would be incredible.
Yeah.
But I really did love the documentary. You did a really great job with it. And for a lot, and I asked you before, like, well, how much should we talk about it in the sense that if people haven't seen it, we don't want to spoil anything. But at the same time, they know. I mean, the thesis statement is in the title.
Yes.
So I feel like if you're comfortable with it, we should talk about it. And even if we talk about some things and people haven't seen it yet, it's still worth watching. Like, yes. This is not a kind of thing you should be like, oh, spoiler. Like, no, you should still watch it because it's culturally important.
Yes.
And I imagine, have you done radio interviews yet? Have you done any radio?
Oh, I've done everything at this point, yeah.
So, because my heart went out to you for the, like, morning radio show onslaught where you get up at, like, 3 a.m. and you do, like, 3 hours. And I'm just guessing that what you've probably had to deal with is just, like, some, you know, really, some of the more aggressive morning shows are like, hey, what's the problem? I mean, it's like, what, is comedy not allowed anymore?
Yeah,
this guy over here.
Yeah. Right. The responses I see on your Twitter is like going like, it's a character.
Right.
Like, that's like the thing that people go for.
It's a character. Apu just got offensive now. All of a sudden, 30 years in, you're just trying to cash in based on going after The Simpsons. I guess you only worry about Indian characters being offensive. You're selfish.
Oh, wow.
You can't do anything in America anymore.
Oh, boy.
Politically correct culture is destroying everything. And then there's the series of different types of harm and death.
Yes.
Well, it's, you know, I think even when I heard about what it was, I had a minute of, like, defensiveness of, like, but wait.
But yeah, yeah.
It's,
yeah.
You know, because it's so much a part of, you know, that show
is
so much a part of who we are as comedy entities because it, you know, it was so influential and it's very, you know, like a lot of us watch it still, you know.
Well, I wonder if it's kind of the thing. I remember being a kid and seeing the Mickey Rooney, you know, the Chinese character from
Breakfast at Tiffany's
and being like, whoa, that's kind of crazy. And then having adults go, it's not crazy. Like, you know, it's just, I wonder because we just kind of grew up with it. That, you know, we didn't really, it's like, not, that's what people are doing now. They're like, oh, but it's been around forever.
Right.
But you know, and I coincidentally, Dana Gould recorded a couple weeks ago, and that podcast will go up next week. If I had known he was in the documentary, I could have asked him about it. Because we had a whole conversation about how it can be tricky to go back and look at comedy from other eras and get mad at it because it's like, well, at the time, because I watched 16 Candles not that long ago.
Right.
And I was like, whoa. Like, there were a couple of, like, holy shit. You know, it's like, especially around the Long Duck Dong character.
Of course, yeah.
And I was like, fuck. I just kind of got sweaty. And, but you go, well, you know, at the time, that they wouldn't have thought, like, this is really offensive. It's like, that's part of what the comedy landscape was at the time.
Right.
And as you evolve, it's good to be able to look back and go, well, we wouldn't do that now. We've learned that that's not okay.
Right. Well, part of it is also the perspective. Like, for me, it wasn't like a looking back and thinking about it. It was like being in the moment.
Yes.
Right? And I think for a lot of Asian Americans, we talked to Randall Park, which didn't make the film ultimately, but, you know, Randall talked about Long Duck Dong and his experience with that. And it was like a similar thing to the Apu thing. It's this idea of this character defining who you are.
Right.
Which seems ridiculous because, you know, there's a lot of ridiculous characters that are like the side of a movie, just like a sidekick, a ridiculous character, but you don't get defined by that person.
Right.
That's just a character. But for us, we get defined by it.
Right.
Like, that's all you get. So, you know, I was asked a question recently, like, you know, does it make you feel weird that people are going to watch The Simpsons now and feel weird about it when they see Apu? And to me, I'm like, I don't think it's weird because I always felt weird about it.
Right.
It was like you watch a show that you love. I love The Simpsons and really influenced by The Simpsons. And you're watching it. And I don't even like, it's weird because Apu's not a bad character. Mm-hmm. I think he's fundamentally flawed, but that doesn't mean he's a bad character. He's like still a good character. And you're watching the show and it's a good plot. And all of a sudden there's a joke in there that is so either racist or absurd. Or it becomes clear that the character isn't written, the show isn't written for you. You're not in the audience. Nobody thought about you. That joke's about you and your family, and you are irrelevant.
And it must feel like you have a really good friend
yes.
who all of a sudden takes a shot, and you're like,
I'm like,
what?
Hey,
I'm here. We were friends. What are you doing?
Them?
Me? Yeah.
For them?
And also,
yeah. Oh, you get it.
And also,
that's exactly. Yeah.
And also, I do want to say, because it, you know, to say like, oh, or now people are going to be uncomfortable. It's like, there's nothing wrong with having to think when mm-hmm. if you're watching something and going, oh, maybe this is, you know, like maybe it's okay to think about whether or not this is okay. And I'm not trying to kiss your ass or sound like I'm super woke or whatever. But I do. But you really did in the course of this documentary change my mind about how I felt about it, which. Now I go, okay, fine, because now I'm in the camp of, hey, look, you know, the character, and this is probably part of the problem with having a show that has been on for this long, is that society has sort of evolved past where they started.
Right.
And, you know, you're right. Like, when you sort of present the idea of, like, how is this different than someone doing any other race and doing, like, a characterization of... You know, like an African American character or an Asian character, whatever. You go, oh yeah, it's really. You would not let a. You would not have a white guy now do. If this show started now, you wouldn't allow that to happen. A white guy doing an Indian character's voice.
I mean, to me, part of it is just each with people of color. Any representation that isn't like, you know, white, male, straight, cis, like every representation that's not in those four. There's so few that each one is weighted more.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, people are like, well, how about you? There's Groundskeeper Willie, right? And you don't have any issues with Groundskeeper Willie? I'm like, look, like, first of all, I didn't know any kids who were Scottish growing up. I don't know how many people did. One. Two, there's other Scottish representations. Three, whiteness is interesting because it kind of eats up ethnicity. People have all these different cultures and parts of who they are. And then all of a sudden, when you ask somebody what they are, they just say white. Mm-hmm. Like, well, no, you have something else. And I think whiteness does that. So someone can have Scottish heritage and it's like, well, Groundskeeper Willie has no impact on me whatsoever. Meanwhile, if you're an Indian American and this is all you have, like, you don't have anything to balance it. There's not a, like... Well, okay, well, there's this immigrant camp, but here's the convenience store owner that's brilliant and actually has a more realistic accent and has a life and has his own sense of humor. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you don't ever have anything else. And that becomes the tricky part.
Well, I think also, too, and there's just this idea of whiteness is that, you know, if you look differently,
yes.
then it's just easier for... people to kind of marginalize or throw you in a box. And I would have to ask Scottish people in America how they feel, but I would tend to guess
right.
that they don't often feel subjugated or like, ah, let's put these Scotties over here.
Right.
And like it right. doesn't, you know, if you kind of said like, hey, what's up? You're a ginger. They'd be like, ah, fuck off. You know, like they
yeah,
would
yeah,
just,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
like it wouldn't really, and it probably has to do with the fact that, you know, they're also white.
Right.
So I really do understand the idea of having a white guy do this character, even though it's like he's been doing it for a long time. Like, yeah. well, yeah, but it doesn't mean he has to do it forever.
You know? right.
And Hasan Minhaj had a really great solution, which was for... For Apu, just one day go, oh yeah, by the way, I'm from the Midwest, which I thought was just a great solution because...
Yeah.
If he just one day said, oh, yeah, you know, actually, I'm from Ohio. And, you know, I was just, I don't know, I thought you wanted me to be this guy and it helped business or whatever, but I'm really this guy. Right. Then it addresses that they were doing that in a way that allows them to sort of like just kind of retire him.
Right.
Or at least like have him talk like that.
Right. Like change the character fundamentally, but also it justifies the previous 30 years.
And if you don't like it, you still got 600 episodes.
Right.
Seymour Skinner is Armin Tanzarian. You know,
I mean, you can change. Oh, characters also die. They disappear.
Yeah, Maud Flanders, she's gone.
So, I mean, it's a cartoon. You can do whatever you want, which is part of the frustration. I think my solution would be, you know, if you're going to say that, well, it's based on a stereotype and stereotypes have some basis in reality, well, a lot of South Asians who have worked in convenience stores end up buying the convenience stores and buy other convenience stores, and then they employ other people. And there's tons of stories of folks who become moguls in that way.
Yeah.
So why not give him some upward mobility? Let him be like a counter to Burns. Like,
right.
That would create a whole different set of plots that we've never seen before. Or like give his kids a voice. Let our generation of Indian Americans be represented in his children. Like,
right.
There's a whole bunch of plots. Points there. I mean, it's the Simpsons. You can really do whatever you want.
And he has eight kids.
Yeah. And also, you know, when people say, what's not, what's the big deal? It's like, well, if you're white, it's not a big deal because it doesn't affect you.
Right.
It's like, yes, to you, it's not a big deal because you don't suffer any of the emotional, you know, but if let's say a white person lived in India and there was a show on Indian television where there's a billion people and that character was like, you know, like a cowboy or like this stereotypical southerner with a mashed up like 9 southern regional accents, and everyone saw you and they'd be like, hey, it's Tex. Yeah, I'm not Tex. I live in California. Not all white people are like that, you know.
Yeah.
Then I think people would I think the white people would really understand, but it's white people are not a minority here, so it's literally, virtually impossible for anyone to understand.
Well, the only, I think, issue with that analogy is that white person would be seen as so fucking cool in India.
Really?
Because he's a white person? Yes! Are you kidding me? We're still, like, some of us are still colonized a little bit. Like, there's some of that, it doesn't just disappear. It's like, oh my God, it's Tex. Like, let's get some, no, you don't need to pay here, Tex.
Yeah.
Like, after, I don't think, I think
howdy.
It's...
Howdy!
Oh, lighter skin? Oh my God, a white person in India? Yeah, that's money, that's prestige, that's...
Shit.
You know, I mean,
gotta
I think in our show, you know, like our shows go over there. Like, you know, people see The Simpsons there. They see all our stuff there. So, you know, it's this really like, you know, I think a lot about that idea of like we base our self-image based on what we see. So like growing up at a certain point, initially I loved the character because holy shit, we exist.
Right.
We didn't exist. And all of a sudden we exist, and then you realize, oh, this is the only way we exist. I know that on Monday I'm going to have to address whatever Apu said the day before because everyone was a Simpsons fan. Mm-hmm. And I also, at a certain point, you start to realize like, oh my God, why do I have to deal with being this color? Why do I have to deal with my parents sounding like that? Why do I have to – I don't want my friends to come over and have to hear my parents because are they going to make fun of them? I don't want them to know anything about our culture because that might be used later. And it's – all this stuff that's like, you know, I was born in this country, I'm a New Yorker, and all of a sudden you're like, holy crap, I don't get to be American completely. It'll mess with your head for a while. Yeah.
Well, I saw, I went to an event the other night and Shonda Rhimes spoke.
Yeah.
And she it's not going to be televised anywhere, but it was one of the most incredible speeches. And it started with her saying, like, her least favorite question, and she gets asked all the time, is, you know, why is diversity important right now? And it's just like, first of all, like, you shouldn't have an answer to that question. But second of all, she says, look, it you know, it's an annoying question because it doesn't focus on the fact that I'm a writer. It focuses on the fact that I'm black and not a writer, you know? And she said, but if you really want me to answer this question, she said in this speech, like, this is the last time this is the only time I'm really going to answer this question. And it was this really beautiful, it was really this beautiful idea of, you know, because I think people who are, you know, who are like defensive about it are people that are like, oh, snowflakes, what do you got? It's like, it's not about filling quotas. It's about representation.
Right.
It's about, you know, this country is a melting pot, and, you know, the majority of people in this country are white, but a lot of people are not. And so making everyone feel like I see myself on television represented in a way that I can be proud of,
right.
And it inspires me to feel like I can do great things or I can do that. And Shonda Rhimes said she didn't see a lot of people when she was growing up on television like her. And then she saw Oprah, who actually presented her award, and Oprah made her realize, oh, I can do that.
Right.
And, yeah. And ultimately where she landed was that's why diversity is important and inclusion is important, because it's about representing, making everyone feel like we're represented and we matter and we yeah. all have things to say and we're not just, you know, we're not just relegated to like a one-dimensional caricature of, right. of something.
Yeah, you know, in a weird version of that, like that's why I wanted to move to the mainland from Hawaii, like as fast as I could, because like in Hawaii, like I didn't feel like I belonged. Like it's like, you know, I got messed with just for being tall, being a nerd, but then also being white.
Right.
And like, it's like, but then all the stuff I saw on TV was coming from like, you know, California. I was like, I got to get over there.
Right.
Cause then I can fit in. And it's such a weird, like opposite version yeah. of like, where it's like, I was like, if I go out there, then the kind of like the way I talk and the way I like to joke around, like it's like they're making that stuff out there. And if I get out there, I'll feel like more, like I'm a part of something.
Right.
And I do in my own family.
Like, right.
Full of like, you know, brown, like it's like my dad's side of the family, you know, they're all brown.
Yeah.
And so I would just like, even family functions and Thanksgiving, I would still get like, you know, made fun
yeah,
of.
Yeah, right.
So he's like, dumb Holly, you know.
Yeah.
So it's
like, yeah. And, yeah. And you know, and I hope it doesn't sound, I hope I don't sound clumsy as like the whitest guy on the planet, you know, is like walking through it. But I would really love to hear more, because I think when people, and this documentary is such a, it's also just a really great comic piece, because you are telling the story about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's the story of you, but set against this larger issue. And so I feel like, you know, I feel like I really got to know you a bit better just by watching this, which is what, you know, like what a comedy piece should really do, is instead of just being funny, but also being insightful. I'm like, oh, I really get it. That's a piece of him. I really get a piece of this guy's soul.
It was funny, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right. That's because at the end of the day, I'm still a comic, right? So, like, if you're going to go after The Simpsons, you better be funny.
Right.
Yeah. Like, there's no, if this thing ends up being serious, I failed. Like, it has to be funny, otherwise, it doesn't work, because it's in The Simpsons tradition of critiquing popular culture.
Right.
I chose the biggest popular culture, piece of popular culture, which is The Simpsons, as far as I'm concerned. So, that was important to me. I mean, yeah, it had to be personal. There has to be someone to follow in the story.
Yeah. And I think you have to be a fan of it too, to be able to like take it on. Cause you're like, it's like, listen, I think it's great, but here's a problem.
Oh my God. I mean, it's shaped so much of how I view comedy. Like, you're allowed to be smart. Some jokes aren't for everybody. Like, every time you watch The Simpsons, there's like, oh, I didn't get that Easter egg. That's an Easter egg. I didn't get it. I knew that, like, you can critique popular culture and you can be political and silly at the same time. Like, all these things being there in the same place, like, I'd never seen anything like that before. Yeah. I mean, that, it's incredible. So as a fan, like, that's why it was tricky. And I think when people say, well, you clearly hate The Simpsons, it bothers me, because like, no, it's like if you listen to sports talk radio and a guy's going off on like, oh God, I can't believe this Mets pitching staff and everyone's getting injured and now Syndergaard's injured and what's wrong with the trainers and they need another bat. Suspes isn't hitting this year. Who's this manager? We got to get a new manager.
Like, that sounds like Katie.
Like, sir, do you hate the Mets? No, I love the Mets. Yes. That's like, that's what you do when you're a fan.
Yeah, yeah,
you
exactly.
want it to be the best it can be.
Yeah.
And so I'm the same way about The Simpsons. Can I say something about, like, it was interesting, just the whole discussion of, like, you mentioned Shonda Rhimes about, like, the importance of diversity.
Yeah.
I've been thinking, like, you know, just over the last week or two, just thinking about that. I think I've broken it down into three things. I think one is decency, which I think is part of, like, what Shonda was saying, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that, like, we all have a piece in this, right? So, you know, growing up as a person of color watching TV, especially in the previous era, before we had all this, you know, so much more media, like, you had to be able to humanize white people. You have to. Because if you were to say, I can't relate to this, there's nobody that looks like me, you can't watch anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So even if a story is nothing like your family or your life as a teenager, you still find the human connections. Like, well, yeah, it's not my family, but I understand the idea of family. And I understand, like, the tensions with parents. And, like, you know, I'm a teen and that's not my life. And they don't need to deal with certain things I deal with, but I get it, you know? You have to find those things. And I feel like that's what frustrates me with the discussions of diversity. Like, well, that's not believable. Nobody's going to watch a thing with that person as the lead. Or that's not, like, that doesn't make sense for a person of color to be that. Or, no, that's a black film because it's, like, black actors. And it's right. like, when I hear that, it's like saying, I, a white person in the audience, cannot see my shared humanity with this person. Oh, shit. And therefore, it's not for me.
Yeah. Right.
And that is such an upsetting idea because we don't have a choice but to do that. And that's important to see each other's humanity. That's such a fundamental part of all of this.
Do you feel like the millennials and even the younger generation that are, you know, toddlers now, little kids now, do you feel like they're seeing less color because of the internet? Because, you know, it's like to some degree, as much as people kind of chunk off in their own kind of specific little forums and groups.
Yeah.
But that that so many people are interacting so much more now.
I think they see color, but it looks different.
Okay.
It looks much different, I think, because they see fuller pictures of people. Like, you know, when you only have a poo, you only see a little sense of something, and it's like a white person's view of you. Now you have creators that are people of color. Like Issa Rae is sharing her story and didn't need HBO. HBO needed her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have like Aziz, you have Mindy, you have all these people that are creating their own stories. And you have kids who are fluent in the internet from like the get-go. Like, there are 14-year-olds that know so much more than I did, like, when I was 20.
Right.
Like, that alone changes everything. Like, I think it's not as simple as, like, all people are like this, or I don't have other images of brown people. Like, yeah, the internet, you'll see other images of brown people.
Yeah, and I thought...
Having sex with each other.
I filter that out.
I thought Asif Manvi had a very great point, because
he's
you were talking about, you know, you talked to him about, well, is it, you know, is it weird when we do it? Like, if we take a character and we, you know, there's And he makes a great point of like, well, we've earned the, like, it's our culture. So it's not, and the way that I think of it for, you know, for anyone, because you see this reaction online a lot where people go, oh, it's okay for your people to do it, but not me to do it. And it's like, yeah, it is. Yeah. Please tell me if this is a flawed analogy. But the way that I would try to relate it to those people who can't seem to wrap their minds around why it's okay is go, okay, look. You have probably said to your friends before, my mom's such a bitch. Boy, my mom's a bitch. But if someone else said, your mom's a bitch, you'd be like, I'm gonna fucking kill you.
Yeah, no, that
it's
is...
It's like, it's your family. Yeah. You have earned the credit, the familial credit or the cultural credit to make it an authentic... But when it's an outsider, it's like, well, that's just mean.
Right, right. Well, if like people have asked, would it have been better if someone else other than Hank Azaria did the voice, if it was a brown person? And no, the character still would have sucked, but at least a brown person would have gotten paid.
Right.
Like, who made the money off it, right?
Right.
And who got the Emmys and all the rest of it. Doing a voice that even Hank says is completely inaccurate, and if he had to do it over, it would have sounded different because he couldn't master the voice. He had to do it quickly, and that's what he came up with.
Right.
Yeah, it's so, like he's already there for other voices, and they're like, oh, hey, we got a new character showing up. That's,
well, it's weird because there's a couple of different stories. One story – that we covered two of the stories. One story is that they told him to do it, and he's like, I don't do an accent well. And it's stereotypical, and they're like, oh, it's fine. Another story, which Mike Reese told during a Cracked podcast – was that it wasn't supposed to be an Indian character. It was written in notes. It's too cliched. No Indian accent. Hank came in and did the voice. Everyone laughed. So now all of a sudden, it's the voice. And there's a third thing I heard from a New York Times writer who was researching it for an article they wrote that, like, apparently in some old TV guide, Matt Groening apparently told Hank to do the voice. So nobody knows exactly why this happened, but I find it interesting that nobody wants to take accountability for it
because
they're embarrassed. Like, this is – it's weird. It's a weird character to look at.
They also – the truth of the matter is it was so long ago they legitimately might not even remember.
It could have been even, like, whoever, like, was, like, in the booth at
the
time.
Right,
you know?
And I don't get the sense that there was any malicious intent. It was just like, oh, it's, you know – because to anyone, something that is different, it has some comedic value because, like, well, it's different.
That's right.
It's different. Oh, it's funny, you know, because I don't. And so they probably were just like, oh, it's silly. And, it, you know, it was at the time that it came out, it was not – that was not an uncommon, you know. But it's just like being open that over time, as you start, understanding things and the humanity of people is like, okay, well, you know, maybe, yes, we did do that for a long time, but that doesn't mean we have to continue doing that, but just because we did.
Sometimes I think it's worse. I think it's worse sometimes when it's not malicious.
Sure.
Because it's so, like, systemic.
And, yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, there's an interesting parallel between what Whoopi said in the piece. Whoopi Goldberg's in it, and she talks about how she has a collection of Black Americana, like blackface and stuff. She calls it a Negrobilia collection. And
they have shots of it, and it's just all this
horrendous,
like, you know, really? Just like bottles of things and posters.
Oh,
and it's
wow.
just, it's like
cookie jars with minstrel images, wow. blackface, and like, it's really awful. And she keeps it there. So like when people enter her house, like they have to acknowledge this is the way it was. And it's like, you can't, like, history is important to understand the context we live in now, which is kind of the point of the film as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I said, well, this is clearly made to hurt Black people. And she's like, well, I don't even think it's that complicated. I think, like, people thought, well, this is funny. This will sell cookie jars. And then I think about Dana in his part. He says that, well, I say it's kind of mechanical that there's, like, four moves. Like, he says, like, you know, like, Burns has these moves and Apu has these moves. And you have to write a show for 30 years. Like, those are the choices you have to make, right? And I said it was mechanical. And he said, well, that's just the way it is. If you're going to get it done, you have to, this is effective and it has to get done. It's funnier when he sounds like this. It's funnier when Barney's drunk. It's funnier when Smithers is not out, you know? And when I think about that, that's just like the cookie jars. It's the same thing. It's the systemic, like, we got to get the job done. This is not malicious. We're not being mean. It's just like, it works and we have to get the job done.
Right.
You know, which, I mean, first of all, let me also say Dana is incredible in the film.
Yeah.
Because he's the only one who's honest.
Right.
Everybody else, like, doesn't want to talk, like, talks. People are like, why was he so, like, such an asshole about it? He's like, he wasn't being an asshole. Do you want him to sugarcoat it?
Right.
He said nothing I didn't know already.
Right.
I was shocked because he was so honest about it.
Right.
Wow. Like, of course, like, a lot of white people find it funny. That's why the character exists. Like,
right.
Of course, this is how you make a show. This is how shows go. You just have to do it quickly. I knew this.
Yeah.
You get limited with choice when you have to do that. So I think Dane is incredible because that is the problem. It's not so much of the maliciousness. It's the, we don't have time to think.
Right.
We're making a product. We don't have, this is art, but now it's a product.
Right.
We have to get it done. And now, Apu action figures are selling. All right, make sure we sell those too. They make money.
Right.
It's all it comes down to.
But you know, but that's the other thing why I love about the piece is that it, you know, it does challenge you to think.
Yeah.
And it puts you in a place, and you know what? It's not always fun to be challenged to think.
No.
Because it's like, well, I already set this on autopilot. I don't have to think about that again.
Right.
And when you have to sit down and think about something, and no one ever wants to think that they're an asshole. So you go like, well, it's not. I mean, what's the harm? Because you don't want to have to face the fact of like, oh, maybe this is hurting people's feelings.
Right, right.
Because then you would have to face that you would have been complicit in that in some way without really realizing or recognizing this larger systemic problem that you're referring to. And then at the end, I was like, and my wife too was, you know, when I told her about this, because the problem of Apu, she was like, oh, I love Apu. And then we watched it and she was like, fuck. He's got some points. And I go, yeah, you know, and if that means that I have to change how I feel about a character or change how I, then that's, you know, like the world is like, our culture right now is at an incredible, it's an incredible upheaval period with things changing.
Yes.
And you know what? And good. Like these are things that need to change, and growth is uncomfortable.
Yes.
Growth is hard.
Yes.
But you have to do it because things, if they're too comfortable or they're too complacent, things are either growing or they're dying. And if you're so worried about something that like, oh, no, it's going to hurt to grow, then you'll just start to die because you will become irrelevant or it won't evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, sometimes you fucking have to get uncomfortable if you want to grow so we can get to a better place.
It's also, it's not only personal growth. Like, I think this is another point about why diversity is important. It's creative growth.
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. if you see Apu, like, it's a lot of the same jokes over the course of the 28 years. Like, whenever it's about ethnicity, it's always, okay, like multiple-headed gods, multiple arms, a billion people, arranged marriage, curry, like his whole identity is the Quickie Mart or the Himalayas, original Quickie Mart.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just the same jokes over and over and over. And it's kind of creatively, like, that's limiting. If you give him more depth and if you have characters that are more interesting, you know, that's just better writing. And also, like, you know, I think Aziz or Alan or somebody had made this point, and I really do think this too. It's like, because our voices as people of color or as women or LGBTQ folks, because the voices were suppressed for so long, everything is new and interesting.
Right.
You know, everything is like, oh, I've never thought of that because it's never been heard. We weren't allowed to talk, right? Like, so for all the people that say, like, why didn't you're complaining about this now? No, I complained for 28 years. I just finally get heard now.
Well, yeah, because social media has given everyone a voice. Where were you supposed to talk about this in 1995 or 1998? You know, like, you'd have to go to, like, you know, like, to a small alternative newspaper in the village.
Right.
And, you know, but then at that point, it's people who are reading that already probably agree with you.
Exactly.
And so you're not reaching beyond the choir.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, like, you know, it's weird for people keep asking me, like, how come you hate Apu so much? And I'm like, I'm 35 years old. To be honest, I don't really give a shit.
Right.
Like, it's been on 30 years. I haven't, like, most of us haven't seen it past season 10.
Right.
Like, this is more about the bigger issues that you and I are, you know, are talking about right now. It's about, like, these bigger things about representation. And this is just a great example. At the end of the day, it's not even about Apu. Like, I just want to see more people share their stories. Like, this Apu story is an old story for me. Like, it wasn't, like, I already knew what this story was. The research was fun. I got to interview a bunch of great people with similar experiences. But it's an old story that we've talked about for, like, 25 years.
Right.
So it's almost like we have to get everyone on the same page. That's kind of what Fresh Off the Boat is.
Mm-hmm.
Fresh Off the Boat is not Eddie Wong's story anymore. That's long gone. That's how they got the show through the door. Now it's the Asian American family sitcom that should have been around 15 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, we're making up for lost time, getting everyone on the same page so it's easier to push forward. And I feel like that's what I want to do with this film. Like, you know, I don't want to be the Apu guy. Like, that's not, like, as a career thing, I don't want to be the one who hates The Simpsons, even though that's not even true. Like, I did this because I think there's a gap to fill.
Yeah, and also, you know, because, especially if someone takes the time to watch the documentary, and even if someone violently disagrees with your thesis statement, I think they should still watch it.
Yes.
And I think they should still at least try to understand the your point of view, because it is so clearly not about, like, I'm trying to get a piece of The Simpsons, or this idea of, like, I'm trying to get rich off The Simpsons. Well, I don't know how rich you think.
No.
Like, but just the idea of, like, hey, I'm a human being. This is an experience that I had.
Yeah.
This is an experience that a lot of people who are from a similar ethnic background had.
Yeah.
It's very human. You know, it's like it's a bummer, like, when you sit down and your parents are there and you talk to your parents and they're like, you know, and they're just resigned of, like, well, it doesn't really, yeah, no, it's not accurate at all, but it doesn't bother us because, you know, like, when we came here, we had to be careful.
They didn't have the entitlement also.
Right.
Like as Americans, we have an entitlement. Well, I deserve what everybody else gets. And for them, they're just happy to be here.
Right.
They're just happy to, you know, to make money and protect their families, man. It was completely different. I mean, part of the film also is me being able to talk about my folks and how much I love my folks. And also, you know, I think part of me was embarrassed that I was embarrassed at any point. And it's a shame. I think there's always a certain point where people of color realize they're people of color. You don't, you know, it's not like you always knew, like, oh, I'm different. Especially, I grew up in Queens.
Right.
Like, I didn't, you know? Like, everybody was another person. And the white people didn't call themselves white people. I didn't know anybody who was white. I did, but they were all Greek or Italian or Irish. And, you know, it's such an ethnicized place. You don't just say you're white. That's for the Midwest. That's not for New York. You know what I mean? Like, we own that identity. So it was just so different. I figured it out when I was watching TV and I realized, oh, I don't exist here.
Right.
That's when I figured it out. And that's when you start to realize that, you know, the rest of the country sees me as different. I don't get to be, you know. And then I went to college in Maine and it solidified it. But, like, the theories were proven correct.
And it's a bummer, too. But even as, like I said, as, you know, someone who's the whitest looking person in the world, there's still... And if at any point I say anything that doesn't sound right to you or sounds tone deaf or whatever, please by all means call me out on it, because there are certain things as a member of the, you know, the ethnic majority in this country that I just fundamentally can't really understand. because I've always been, well, there's always been, you know, 300 million people who look like I do.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But it, you know, this country really, at least it, in all of this, in the songs we were taught in school and the stories we were taught in school, is supposed to be a melting pot. It's supposed to be a land of opportunity for everyone.
Yeah.
And yet there are certain cultural things that happen that seem contrary to that.
Yeah.
So what's the, like, what is the, what are some of the solutions? I mean, outside of The Simpsons, what do you see as being part of the solution to try to get everything back?
I mean, I think part of it is definitely diversifying what you watch on media. You know, I try to see, like, films or shows which you normally wouldn't see, because it forces you to be like, oh, these are all characters, are all people of color, and I'm not in this, and that's okay. You know, that it doesn't need to be completely about me. Part of it, I think, just naturally, like, it's really about money. At the end of the day, like, you know, people aren't creating these shows out of a sense of goodwill. It's because they're like, oh, they have money too? All right.
Right.
You know? Plus, it's not like the old days where you have a few cable channels and some broadcast and everybody wants the biggest piece of the pie. Now people want a piece of the pie.
Right.
So if you find that niche and you reach that base, you have that piece.
Right.
And also, like I was saying before, our stories have been suppressed for so long. That's new. That's fresh. No one's ever done that before. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody wants that. So I feel like diversity is also beneficial from the point of view of an industry. You want the next thing, and you have an audience that's bored of the same old things. We recreate everything. I mean, that's why the Apu voice lasted so long to begin with, why actors were being told to do it, because we do the same thing over and over and over again until it doesn't work anymore.
Right.
So, well, okay, that's not the action we want. We want the one that's on the show that everyone else does.
Right.
I mean, so I feel like a big part of it now, because media is so diversified, is it's just going to happen, and you just have to support those shows when they come out. And also to your other point regarding, like, I'm not getting rich off this. I am not getting rich off this. I cannot share my contract with you, but I will tell you for a fact, I am not getting rich off this, and I don't, based on the details of my contract, and under no scenario will I get rich off
this. Well, I hope people can watch this. I hope that there are people who can watch this and not just take it as an immediate personal attack on something that they love, and watch it from the point of view of, like, this is a guy who is a human being who had this experience with this thing,
mm-hmm.
and I should be, and he's allowed to tell you his experience,
right.
Like, without you feeling threatened.
And I'm a comic.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, that's the other thing that annoys me, for all the talk of, like, you don't know how comedy works. I'm like, fuck off. I don't know. You don't know how satire works. Like, you know, look, comics are supposed to take challenging subjects and do the best. I mean, that's why you know when someone's a hack and when someone isn't, because it's like, oh, you're doing that in the way that everyone else did it.
Yeah.
Like, this is not an easy thing to do.
And again, mm-hmm. If you like found some random guy who was bitching at you about fuck you, you're trying to ruin, and you go okay, and then you just got some basic information about that guy's mom, and then you put on a wig and the same kind of dress his mom would put on, and like, you know, like whited out your face a little bit, and just like did like a put like a extra lipstick, and just started being like, you better come down for dinner. The guy would be like, what the fuck are you doing?
It's I would then be killed.
But just for people who have a hard time understanding, it's like it is. You know, it marginalizes your family, and you care about your family, and it hurts. Like, it doesn't. I can't imagine that it feels great.
Well, it's also kind of like, you know, when we talk about like police brutality and stuff. It's like, you know, why do these cops keep shooting black men? So, well, how many images do they have in their head of black men, and what images do they have? What images do they grow up watching in the media? And this is all that we have. These like few number of images of violence and gangs, and all of a sudden you have a gun on you and you're scared. What pops into your head? And that's another reason why representation is important, because when you don't know a broad range of people, especially, look, this is a segregated society and it's fucking sad, but we live in a segregated country, whether because of economics or like race and fear, whatever it is, there's a whole bunch of reasons, but we don't mix the way we're supposed to mix.
Sure.
And as a result, like media ends up dictating how we view other people. And I think a lot about 9/11, because I remember after 9/11, I remember so many brown people being detained and deported and beaten up, Muslim, Sikh, brown, didn't matter, right? And I think, why? Why would in this when we're mourning as well? When I'm a New Yorker as well, born and raised, like, why is this happening? And I think, well, what are the two major images of brown people in this country post 9/11, right before that point? You had Apu from The Simpsons, harmless convenience store, you know, owner, like, no real impact. And you have terrorists.
Right.
Terrorist attack just happens. Which side are you going to err on at that point?
Right.
There's a huge range of humanity between those points
that
nobody thinks about. But with Las Vegas, for example, no one's going after every middle-aged white dude because it's like we know many middle-aged white dudes.
Right.
That would be an absurd idea. Are you saying Tom Selleck and Ted Danson are the same?
Right, right,
you know,
right.
Like, I don't know why those two exist. But
one's got a mustache, idiot.
Tom Selleck shaved his mustache. Get it right, Jonah.
I watch Blue Bloods. I know.
Oh, my God.
That's why Danson needs to grow the mustache.
Yeah.
But to your point about 9/11, in the documentary, you talked about how for like 4 or 5 years preceding 9/11, you were, I guess, the way you had framed it was giving the audience what you thought they wanted, which was an Indian comic doing Indian voices. And, you know, stand-up comedy is very interesting in terms of entertainment because, you know, diversity can be a real strength.
Yes.
Because, you know, there are so many white guy comics and it's like, well, how do you stand, you know, but if you're diverse, it immediately, you know, allows you to stand outside the pack a little bit, but also at what cost? Do you feel like, well, do I have to give what people expect people who look like me to do?
That's
or can I just be a comic? Can I just be a comic?
Right. With the full range.
Right.
Right. I mean, I think for me, all comics, I think for the most part, when they start, are hacks.
Right.
We're all trying to make people laugh, and you do whatever you can because silence is the scariest thing in the world. And you're an Indian kid, and there's no other examples. And the one thing I knew is that Indian accents work, and I knew that because I was a Simpsons fan.
Oh, shit.
So it's this has proven to be very effective as a weapon against me, so I will use this weapon to get laughter. And so that's what I did, you know, in addition to like taking Chris Rock and Margaret Cho jokes and adding the word Indian to them, essentially. But I mean, like that was like the early part. I mean, I think that the numbers were fudged a little bit on our part in terms of the movie. It was more like 2 years of doing stuff. I started when I was 17. The 9/11 happens. And then there was like 2 to 3 years of like me trying to write politically, but not wanting to get rid of the hacky stuff.
Sure.
Because I needed laughs.
Yeah.
So here's the stuff that's preachy that I don't know how to make funny yet. And then there's the, because I remember I saw Paul Mooney do stand up for the first time. And I never laughed so hard because I'm like, you can make people walk out. Like, white people can walk out and you're okay.
Yeah.
And most of the audience was people of color. And I remember seeing that thinking, I want to do that. I want to make people uncomfortable too. And the thing is, when I tried to do stand-up after that, I came across as a, like, 60-year-old black man in an Indian man's body trying to do stand-up because I was just trying to do Mooney.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, you got to talk about your experiences.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
I'm talking about the civil rights movement. I'm like, what are you – like, looking at it now, it's very embarrassing. So I was doing the civil rights movement, talking about – poverty and injustice, and also my parents sound like this.
Right.
Like, it's like, it, like, there was such a...
It's just a little bit of a disconnect.
Because, like, I need the laughs at the end of the day. Everyone else is like, what is he doing?
Yeah.
His mom.
Yeah, it's basically like, you know, it's like, but play the hit!
Right, exactly.
I don't want to hear the new stuff.
Yeah.
Like, just get to the hit!
And you can go anywhere you want and just get no laughs, and you're like, it's okay. I got the grenade in my back.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah.
My heart so goes out to you because you know, comedy is so hard as it is, and you know, like, you can have a really good set, but if you did material that you're not proud of to get that good set, you can't chalk it up to a win. You can also have a set that doesn't go as well, but if you believe in everything you're saying and you feel good about everything you were doing on stage, then you're like, well... So they just didn't get this tonight.
Yeah,
and that's
they can go
okay.
to hell. I know what I said was good.
So, you know, knowing that you were in a position where you were like, I need to kind of sell this out a little bit so that I can feel like I is, that is a bummer. And I'm really sorry that but at least you, that was part of your growth process.
And least I was 17, 18, 19 versus like 28, 29, 30. I figured that out fairly. Cause I was always decent at writing a joke. I just didn't have anything to talk about. And I was a kid, right?
Right.
One thing that bummed me out, and recently I've decided to change, is like for the longest time, I wouldn't talk about my family. And when I talked about race, I would talk about it more like in big terms without getting too specific.
Yeah.
Just because I didn't want to be accused of being hacky.
Right.
And being like an ethnic hack. That was always the fear. Like, well, don't talk about your parents ever. Just talk about race, but like not in any way that includes you. And then, you know, a few years ago, I'm like, people's parents are kind of important in their life.
Yeah.
They show up. They sometimes don't show up. They have important, like they shape you. Why am I not allowed to talk about my folks? It's really about how I talk about them. Mm-hmm. So now I talk about my family and my childhood experiences. I mean, I don't do them with accents.
Right.
First of all, because I can't do accents. But when I did accents, ironically enough, I was just doing an impression of Hank Azaria.
Right, right,
right. But that's the only Indian accent I really know how to do, really, right? Right. So it's kind of sad, but like I like the fact that finally I'm able, after all these years, to like take risks and feel like I don't need to be judged based on like XYZ, because there's enough of us now between Kumail and Mindy and Aziz and Hassan and Asif and Cal and, you know, Parnanan Cherla. Like, I don't need to think about, oh, if I'm, you know, there was a certain point where I think it was me, Kumail, Aziz. I think that was the only ones of us on TV for like 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And it was just like each one of those things is like a big thing. Like if I do a joke that even slightly seems hacky, then everybody has to deal with it. Or like I look really terrible.
Well, that's why it's really helpful that, you know, like in Silicon Valley, Kumail's character has nothing to do with where he's from.
Yes.
He's just a nerd.
Yes.
And it's
yes.
like, you know, it doesn't really matter that, you know, that character could have been any ethnicity, and he would have been a nerd. You know, the fact that it's Kumail, he's a comic genius, so it's amazing. But the more that's just folded in, and it's like the more, you know, the Brusco people, it just kind of like makes them colorblind and like, oh, he's just a guy. He's just a nerd.
Well, what I love though is I love you've seen The Big Sick, right?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, what I love about The Big Sick is that it's this perfect melding of him being a guy, just a human falling in love, but like his ethnicity is still a key part of who he is. So you get to see a full person. It's not someone hiding, and it's not a person who's afraid of who they are. It's both.
Right.
You get like this full human being, and I think that's what we want more than anything in the world. Like, there's this musician I love. His name is Jay Paul. He's like one of those mysterious like Salinger types, mm-hmm. who like releases something and disappears for years. Like he had this album that was in the works years ago, and then someone leaked it, and he's been missing for 5 years now. But his stuff, he's like a British like DJ musician, and it's this incredible mix of like hip hop and electronic and old Bollywood music, and his beautiful like almost R&B type singing, and I'm like all mixed into one thing, and I'm listening to this, and I'm like, this is what I want for my comedy. I want to be my full self. I want all that stuff. I want the Indian stuff. I want this, all the stuff I was influenced with growing up. I want the things I'm worried about. I want anger. I want sadness. Like, I want the full range of human emotions and experiences. And I hear his music, and I'm like, that's what I want. Like, to be everything.
Yeah.
Because we're all everything. We're not just one thing or another. We're like all those things at the same time.
And I think some of that also just comes with like the age. You're like 35.
Yeah.
You get some wisdom. You get some perspective.
Yes.
And you're able to – you've had enough experience at that point where you're able to have the point of view where you can talk about things authentically, because you start to become more comfortable with who you are, and you start to get a real sense of how the world is.
Yes.
And you're not so scared in it anymore. You're like, oh, okay, yeah. I'm.
What was your moment? Like, what for you? What was the thing where, like, okay, I this is who I am. I'm going to talk about this, and this is one of those bits where I'm like, I wouldn't have done it well, or I wouldn't have done it at all.
It was my dad dying suddenly. Right. It was where it was like, oh, can I talk about this? I'm like, well, this is an experience that I had, you know, and other people have it, and I want to demystify it in some way, and it's a part of this process, and you know. Because, you know, after you, and Jonah knows too, unfortunately, quite recently, but when something like that happens, it puts everything into perspective, because then, you know, you can get really upset about some dumb thing, and you're like, oh, well, at least this isn't my dad dying, you know? Like, it does create a little bit of perspective and reflection and a little, that you didn't really have before, because, you know, when you're younger, you just take everything for granted, because you just think everything's permanent. And when you start to realize, it's really The thing that kind of starts to drive your midlife crisis is actually weirdly kind of thing that gives you reflection.
Yeah.
Because it's the really the midlife crisis is really the first time in your life where you go, oh, this isn't forever. There's there's an end point, and I'm like halfway there.
Right.
Like if I double the age I'm at now, I'm probably dead, you know? And so that is what gives you a sense of humanity and mortality, and I think that's where the ability to go deeper comes from, because you're just not as caught up in stupid things anymore. I think I still get caught up in dumb things. I'm not. It didn't cure every problem, but it created a little more reflection than I had had before.
And you were able after that. You've been able to get a lot more personal, like when you're on stage.
Yeah. And you know, it feels better. And there are times when people don't laugh as hard because it's like, well, that's, you know, yes, there's a human thing to take away, but that's also very personal, and maybe they, you know, so it's finding like, can you talk about things that challenge people and are a little uncomfortable, but ultimately you can take them through it. And I think that's really the master, that's becoming like the comedy Gandalf is that process of knowing how to take people to an uncomfortable place, but then, and that's the thing, like Patton is so, it's just like, he's Dumbledore. Like he's masterful.
Oh, that last special, my God.
That was insane. And so you just can't, you know, but that's learned.
Yes.
Because you just have to get through that. You just have to get through that process. But you know, when you were talking about Kumail before, and particularly the Big Sick, the part where you really go, holy shit, you just don't think about the struggles that people have of, you know, being a first-generation American.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were kind of talking about Kurt's character.
No. All right. Kurt really had a struggle in there. But being a first-generation American and being in this weird purgatory place where it's like, well, the white people, you're a little bit of an outsider to the white people because your skin is brown, and you're a little bit of an outsider to the people who are from where your parents are from because you're American.
Right.
And so you're just in this weird place of like, well, where do I fit in?
Right.
You know, like how can I just be a person?
Plus he's dealing with like the religious aspect too, which those scenes where he's like pretending to pray. I'm like, those are unbelievable. Like that's so, or there's this one part right when he finally talks to his parents and confronts them and tells them the truth, and he says this one line that I'm like, that is so cool he put that in, where he says like, how he says he doesn't believe in Islam, he's like, you know, Islam, it was great for you, it made you into the great people that you are. And I'm like, that is such an important thing, because it tells you like, this is somebody who's not saying I'm choosing this over this. And he's saying that this is all part of who I am, and because you're part of who I am, and so I love you, and this is good for you. So it's not me running from the religion; it's just not me. Mm. I'm like that level of depth. Yeah. Like I'm just like I never thought we'd get to a place where we'd see a scene like that. Like I saw that, and I'm like, holy crap!
That was a great scene.
Well,
it's nuts.
But also, you know. If there had been better representation when you were growing up, do you think you would have still pursued comedy, or do you think you would have?
Huh.
Do you think you would have? And I'm not that I'm saying like, hey, it's great that you had to grow up feeling weird, but you know, but I think a lot of comedians become comedians because they're uncomfortable or because they're trying to deal with, you know, all the things we feel like self-hatred or like anger or like whatever it is that we're trying to deal with, you know. But the fact that you're able to take those emotions and try to spin it in a way that is relatable and also educational, but makes people think, but makes people laugh at the same time. You know, like do you have any thoughts on that as an idea?
I'm just thinking about it now, cause I've never thought about that. Like if there was more, would I be who I was? Cause I remember the reason I wanted to start doing stand up is I saw Margaret Cho do stand up, cause she had that old, you remember that leather body suit HBO special?
Yeah.
She talks about the ass master and her mom being in charge of the gay porn section of the bookstore in San Francisco.
Is that the one where she says like her mom doesn't understand her gay friends? She's like, oh, I'm going to hang out with my friend. Is he I'm not going to do her voice. Is he the gay? Yeah. I don't know if he's the gay.
Yeah,
he's like one guy in a parade. Hey, everybody.
Yeah. And she talks about her brother being super Christian, like, Margaret, have you chosen Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? God. I just remember seeing that, and, you know, just growing up seeing, like, black, white, Latino stand-ups, it's like, holy crap, Asian-American woman talking about her family and a bunch of other stuff, like, she's still groundbreaking. And I was just like, I mean, it was the most inspiring thing in the world. So if we had more, would that have inspired me, I wonder, or would somebody else have? And part of me is like, do stand-ups have no choice? Like, is it just so in you that you just have to?
I think so. And the reason that I think it is, and the reason why anyone who says, I'm thinking about trying stand-up, I go, do it. Try it like 100 times and see how you feel. Because I think only someone... Because I think stand-up is a little bit of a flaw. When people go, wow, how can you do stand-up? I go, it's... I don't think I chose it. I just think I know that if I don't do it, I feel weird. Like, I need to. It's that thing of, you know, bombing in front of three people at a laundromat and hating yourself and going, I have to do this again tomorrow night. That is the fundamental thing. That
we're sick.
It is a sickness.
Yes.
It's a weird thing to do, to go, I'm going to get up in front of strangers and create a response that means that they like me.
Right.
You know, like,
but don't you have friends and family that you make laugh and love? Yes, but it's not enough.
It doesn't. It's like when your mom is like, you're handsome. It doesn't count. Yes.
I want people who don't really know or care about
Yes, I need their approval.
So, I mean, it's funny because I feel like I tried to run away from stand-up so many times. Like, I remember, like, after I did in high school, I'm like, I'm not going to do it through college. Then I went to college in Maine. I'm like, oh, I'm the only brown one. I got to do stand-up. This is the only way where I get to choose how I want to stand out.
Right.
So I did it then. I'm like, then I quit. And then I'd seen how the New York scene worked. I'm like, oh, I'm not going to make my friends buy 40 tickets so I could do 5 minutes.
Bring her shows.
I don't have enough friends to keep this going. And so then I went to Seattle to be an immigrant rights organizer, and, you know, small scene. I'm like, all right, I do comedy at night. And I got discovered by J.P. Buck at the HBO Comedy Festival.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
And
he's a Conan now.
Conan, he's still, I mean, he's the one who found me in Seattle when you can discover people, for the internet was such a, like, you just look at people's YouTube clips. And I was on Kimmel, and I had a manager, and it was like, this wasn't the plan at all. And even then, I was, you know, I already had gotten into this grad school program at the London School of Economics for a human rights master's degree. So I ended up going there because I didn't think this comedy thing was real. Because, like, they never let us in before. Like, you're telling me I can do this now?
How far did you get with that program?
Finished it.
So you have your master's degree in human rights. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
That's how much I didn't trust stand-up. Where I'm like, this isn't going to happen. In the middle, I hadn't done stand-up for 6 months, and then all of a sudden I get Live at Gotham, you know, the old showcase show on Comedy Central. I hadn't done stand-up forever. I had to go. I missed a unit of class. I missed my South African Truth and Reconciliation unit. Flew back to New York, had to relearn my act.
Wow.
Do it on TV, go back and finish my dissertation, and didn't do stand-up again for like 4 months.
Oh my God.
And then I decided, like, they opened a door. I don't know why this is open right now. It felt disrespectful to all the comics I knew in Seattle who were like the real road dogs, who'd never been on TV, who were damn good comics. Like, people think if you're on TV, you're a great comic. That doesn't mean you're a great comic. There's a bunch of comics who just for whatever reason couldn't break through.
Right.
For whatever reason. And there's a wide range that we know of why that can happen. But, like, yeah, I mean, like, it felt like they busted their ass for 15, 20 years and haven't gotten this. And I just was given this and I'm supposed to walk away from it.
Right.
And, like, all these years, like, this thing seemed so far away because, like, nobody wants to listen to me, and why on earth would I do it? Now all of a sudden you're telling me I have it?
Yeah.
They're letting me do it. Like, I have the infrastructure of a career.
Wow. And so you must do you feel a greater sense of responsibility having the education that you have with that particular subject matter of how do I use comedy to promote human rights?
No, because it's too, you know, stand-up is too egocentric to be. We're egomaniacs. If you add the world-changing element, the level of power is sick. You can't. I try to think of each, it's one joke at a time, one show at a time. Like, at the end of the day, if it's not funny, if it's not making people laugh, it's not working, and you can't use that joke. It's about making it work. And, you know, it's not to say if it doesn't work, I'm going to change my whole act in front of an audience. It'll be my point of view, but I'm going to make the jokes work somehow. That has to be my job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I think about it. I don't see myself as an activist doing comedy or anything else. I'm a comedian. Like, that's it. And that's how I try to approach it. I'm just like everybody else, except this is my point of view.
Well, when you start out doing comedy, it's just to go back to what you said about, you know, having to invite 40 friends. You're chasing audience because you need an audience to perform. God. No one knows who you are,
yes.
So why would they come see you if they know who you are? And then you get to a certain point, and I think this also helps with doing the more personal material, where you can sit back a little bit and let the audience come to you.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, that's refreshing. It's spoiling. I mean, it can be very different if you go into a room where people don't know you and you've been performing in front of your people for your own crowd for a while. And you're like, oh, these people don't give a shit. I have to prove to them that I'm okay. But it, being in that place where it's freeing because you can talk about whatever you want to talk about. And it's like, well, if you don't want to stay, there are many fine comedy choices for you in this world. And then it's just each time you go through a city, you'll pick up a few more people and more people and a few more people.
That I feel like that the place I'm at right now is like there's certain cities where I'm playing to the home crowd, right? But, you know, I just did Dead Crow in Wilmington, which is a great club, by the way. It's a small room, wonderful club. But that's like – it's not a home run city for me. It's like a purple, like some people are real. But they're really, it could go either way. And, you know, and none of those shows were easy and they all went well. Because I had to work. I had to work, but I still made it work. And I feel prouder of that than the other things. The other things, you're on autopilot. You know, you can dick around. You can do whatever you want. And those, it's like, you're on. If you're not on, you're not going to win.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's when I feel the proudest. It's like, oh, okay, they didn't laugh at that. I found a way out of it. I found a way to, the next show, I found a way to explain that concept in a way they got. So now I have a better way of explaining the joke to set it up. And, like, I mean, that's where the real work is. But you're right. I think when you get so used to playing for like doing home games, when you're away, you're like, I don't know. Why are you talking right
guys,
now?
Guys, it's me. Yeah, we don't know who you are.
It's NPR's Hari Kondabolu. I don't understand. Terry Gross, anybody?
National Public Rodeo.
No, it's National Public Radio. Radio, but this was really the wrong crowd.
I love their show, This American Life.
This is This American Life reminding you that you might be a redneck.
A podcast that does that.
You're listening to Bob Wills and his Texas Takeover.
Yeah, that'd be God. That's why. Where is that?
Where is that? That should exist.
Someone needs to make that pronto.
Is National Public Radio real? Rodeo real? Tell me that's real.
I don't think it's real. No, I don't think it's real. I don't think it's real.
I want it to exist the way like there was two WWFs for a while,
right?
the wildlife and the wrestling. Yeah. And somehow the wildlife won.
Yeah.
Holy crap!
Yeah, it was a cage match. And Panda beat the Undertaker.
Yeah.
So Panda won. The actual panda. The actual panda won. But, you know, sort of, do you, and by the way, oh, I didn't even mention the fact that Cal Penn is hilarious.
It's so funny.
Because he just flat out goes, oh, I hate The Simpsons. You know, because Hari goes, yeah, my friend. He goes, oh, I hate it. I fucking hate it. I don't like it.
He really hates it.
Never liked it. And Hari goes, yeah, but there's so many. He goes, I can't get around it. I just can't get around it. Hates it.
He's older than us, right?
Yeah, because he also he's the monkey brains generation, right before me. So I think for him, he was already worn
Temple
out.
Of Doom, Temple of Doom,
yeah. Short Circuit.
He was done with that. Yeah. But by the time Apu came around, this was just an extension of those experiences.
Yeah, yeah. You
know? Oh yeah, that's right. He has a guy on the street who his favorite Indian character, and then he goes, the guy from Short Circuit. I was like, those fish are
the TV trailer. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I didn't figure that dude was an Indian until like 3 or 4 years ago. I'm like, where'd that actor go?
Yeah, I never thought about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he got banned from India for over a decade after that.
Oh, wow.
Because it's like, really? You're going to do this to us?
Yeah.
You had a billion choices here.
Right.
Yeah.
Was there not enough choice? Right. There was not enough choice, I guess. Yeah. I'm sorry.
If only there was some massive industry of film in this country.
I mean, how could we at all?
So,
I don't know. So, I mean, you know, what are you hoping happens from this? Because I know one of the through
lines, I want a TV show.
You want a TV show. Okay, great.
Yeah, that's what I want.
well, one of the through lines is again, this, still you should watch this, even though we're talking about this, but it's will Hank Azaria not show up in the documentary? And he does not.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because to me, I understand your frustration, but I also understand why he doesn't do it. Because I guess from his point of view, especially in a world now where like outrage just, it's just like
right.
spins so fast and right. it's like, oh, I had a career like an hour ago
right.
and I don't now, you know, you know, if he saw your initial piece on Totally Biased, where you're like, I want to kick the shit out of Hank Azaria, yeah. or I want to think about kicking the shit out of Hank Azaria, it's really funny. He's probably just scared, you know? He just like, I don't know how you're going to edit this, or I don't know how this is going to come off. Like, how do you feel about that now?
Well, I feel like, honestly, I feel like it wasn't his best interest to be in it, because I think you get points for trying.
Of course.
Always get points for trying, and also you control the narrative more than you think, because we have archival stuff. I mean, that wasn't the issue, and the movie would have felt different if he was in it. And I think some people have like, well, it's better that he wasn't in it because you had such a fun ending. And I'm like, I would have rather had an adult discussion that is full of variables that could have been great for comedic possibilities, in addition to showing like, hey, look at two adults having a conversation about something that is not the most important thing in the world that they have a disagreement on, and they come to some kind of resolution even if they're not in agreement. Like,
but does he have? But he doesn't have the power to decide. I guess he.
No,
I guess he could if he was like, hey, you know what, Fox.
Maybe
I'll do every other
do
character
this.
For you,
right?
But you know, maybe this one we should really yeah. not. Maybe I shouldn't
and,
do this
and
one
at the
anymore.
End of the way. At the end of the day, you know, for the sake of the plot, you need to push something through. Like there has to be a through line. We got to find him. You know, like a Roger and me thing. But
yeah.
To me, it's like I just wanted the conversation because it would have been an interesting. Like, do you feel weird about doing it? What is it like to do it? And also, it's not your best accent, and you know that. So does that kill you because you know you could do a different one? And like, there's all these questions that I just would have been cool. And I talked to him on the phone actually.
Afterwards?
No, like during. We didn't put it on the thing because it was the cameras weren't there. It was just me in my apartment. He wanted to have a conversation.
Yeah.
So we exchanged numbers and we were on the phone, and he was really kind. And he was saying how he had seen my piece and he'd watched a ton of my stand-up since then and he really likes what I do. And, like, I'm geeking out.
It's hard not to be, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, that's the voice of Mo! Like, time it's like, this is so fucking cool. And also, like, you're in Gross Point Blank. I love Gross Point Blank.
It's also in Ray Donovan.
Yeah.
That's true.
And so, like, I'm, you know, geeking, but at the same time, like, I'm like, I really want him to be in the film. And he said that, he came up with a compromise, which I thought was a good compromise, which is if we find another forum, like whether it's WTF with Marc Maron or Terry Gross or whatever it is, we find a place where there's like a third-party recording, that way I can't really fuck with the edit because there's proof, right? There's an actual long recording. And I said yes because I think the movie's partly about accountability. It's about how people can reconcile and, you know, find some common ground. And, you know, I was cool with that. I'm like, let's do that. And I don't know if he expected me to say yes, because then, you know, a couple of months later, he's like, I can't do it.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing I read in the movie. Like, after I said it, he still said no.
So you didn't really exchange any thoughts on the subject while you were on the phone. It was just more about if we were going to talk about this,
yeah.
what would it
yeah.
be?
Yeah, and I really still want to talk about it. I still think it would be fun to have a really interesting conversation because, again, I'm not really angry. It's been 30 years. We're in a different point. In you know, in the history of media and in our country, like, to me, this is just like, hey, people, look at the fact that, you know, you're calling this a politically correct movie and we're talking about this old character, but look at how the person who does the voice and the person who has the issue with it are talking and coming up with some ideas. And
right.
I think that just would have been cool for people to see. Nobody sees that. Nobody sees like a civil, thoughtful conversation.
I've been dying, I feel like it was like 2 years ago. I said it would be really great to have a podcast just called like Civil Discourse, and no one's ever allowed to yell. Is that everyone
yes.
like that? It even if you're on completely opposite sides of
yeah.
an issue,
yeah.
that you have to do it like couples counseling,
yeah,
where someone says, "Okay, I hear what you're saying,"
yeah,
but because you know the best way to really communicate with people is. Not to say you, but say I.
This is how I feel,
yeah. and this makes me feel. Because everyone understands feelings. Like, everyone has feelings.
Yeah.
So, you know, much in the way that if people watch this documentary and look at it from not the point of view of, like, you know, you shouldn't, or you, of just like, I am a human who had this experience, and I feel this way, and here's why. And I think it's very hard for someone to be like, fuck that guy.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
but he had this experience, like, his whole life. What do you can't discount that he feels this way.
Right. And for the people who do discount it, I mean, I feel like there's nothing you could have done at that point.
Right.
Right. I mean, wait, so with that idea, like, how extreme would the pairings be? Would it be like, Anthony from Opie and Anthony and like Angela Davis? Like, what would the...
I have no idea because I don't know... I think you'd really have to experiment with the dynamic. First of all, with some softer ideas to see if it works.
Yes.
You know, because our culture now is such a... it's such a toxic finger in the chest culture.
Yeah.
That I even find that, like, there are people online that I agree with where I'm like, we could talk, like, we could talk, like, but I think people now, because it's so much more about getting your voice heard above the noise, that you just have to be noisier and noisier and noisier.
Yeah.
And that unfortunately does not pave the way for understanding or conversation.
Yeah.
And so I think you'd have to really see if it even worked, if you could get two people who didn't agree on something, and they don't have to agree by the end, right. But it's just the idea that they have to face each other and talk like human beings, not that fucking CNN style thing where they're in separate studios, they're shouting at a camera.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so much different when you're interfacing with a machine than when you actually...
It can't feel like an old school wrestling promo.
It can't. Yeah. It can't feel like a promo, but just to... And you really would need like someone to moderate it who... could pull the humanity out of both sides, like a marriage counselor or someone who, or a therapist or
Funches.
Someone. Yeah, Funches.
Funches always... or Gondelman. I feel like those are the two nicest guys in comedy.
Okay,
I think
calm down.
All right. So what are you doing? Like, what's next? This is going to air on Sunday. Are you nervous about it airing? Because you put so much work. Like, it's like, this is it. It's actually people are going to get to see it now.
No, I'm not nervous. I mean, because I think I've gotten so much awful hate from people who haven't seen it yet. That I'm like, how much worse can it get?
That's just the internet.
At this point, it'll be like... critical, like the stuff that's thoughtful and critical.
What if you watched it and then got mad? Like, it's okay to get mad.
Right.
But maybe just consume the thing,
like,
and then
half
you could...
your concerns are addressed in the thing.
I spent a lot of time trying.
It's not politically correct. Who makes a politically correct documentary that takes a year and a half to finish and requires money and time? It's not worth it. I can't wait for it to get out and see where those conversations go. And then, you know, I'm planning to tape a special at the end of the year. So I'm like gearing up and touring and getting ready for that whole process.
Well, awesome. I'm such a fan of yours, and it was such a great piece. And I'm so happy that you were able to make it. And I really do thank you for the opportunity to kind of explore something that was kind of just on autopilot in my head and go like, oh yeah! Wait a minute. You know, it was a really fun experience.
Thank you. I mean, honestly, and I've, you know, it's funny because I feel like, you know, obviously I've done the show and I've known you for a minute, but I feel like we never really have had a conversation before.
Did we meet the first? Was it
John Oliver's? Yeah, season one.
Like,
yeah,
2009. Yeah, 19.
And Kristen's parents were there.
Yes, Kristen Schaal's parents were there,
and they liked my hair, and I. It was the sweet. Her mom was so nice. Her dad too, and I just remember, like, you know, we never have had a conversation really since, because, you know, the show's happening and I go in
and you're East Coast,
and I'm East Coast, and they're all West Coast people, so there's like, I don't know the scene here as much, and so this really felt nice. So thank you for inviting me to your home.
It was an absolute pleasure. I hope people watch the special. And also, I used to, the other thing that I would geek out on you about is that your brother is in the band Das Racist.
Yeah, yeah.
Am I saying it right? Das Racist.
Das Racist.
Yeah.
It's from the Wonder Shows. From the Wonder Shows, an episode where the kid's like, "That's racist."
Yes. Are they still touring?
Oh, they broke up a long time ago. Thank God.
Okay.
Yeah. that was enough of that. Yeah. But
yeah.
No. But Himanshu's doing his own thing. Vic's doing his thing. And my brother's been, you know, he's working on his own TV projects and stuff.
That's fantastic.
So, yeah.
There's no longer a combination Pizza Hut and Taco Bell.
Pizza Hut one way, Taco Bell went the other way.
It was nice. Those moments were hard when he was more famous than I was. When he got on Conan before I did, I've been working so hard. This is my dream thing, to get on Conan more than anything in the whole world, and you just stumbled into it?
You just named a business?
Yeah.
And that gets you on Conan now? Well, thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks, Chris.
And, you know,
I appreciate it, man.
Anything we can do for you, please let me know.
Absolutely, dude. Thank you.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies and brands to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.